halfway around the world to a recently emerging epidemic of injection drug use and concomitant HIV infection. The Russian epidemic really began in the mid-1990s, and if you'll notice, if you look at the data from the period from 1987, when the first AIDS case in Russia was identified, until 1995, the majority of cases were among non-injection drug users, nosocomial infections, heterosexual transmission, MSM transmission, and about 20% unknown, and almost no infections in drug users. And in 1 year, between 1987 and 1995, there were 1,000 cases diagnosed in Russia. In 1996, there were another 1,000 cases diagnosed in 1 year alone, and 63% of them were in drug users, 23% of them were unknown. So you get a complete shift in the nature of the epidemic between before 1995 and 96. And what we've seen since then is dramatic, one of the fastest growing HIV epidemics in the world. The solid bars are the number of newly diagnosed cases in each year, peaking, at least in terms of identified cases, in 2001, and mounting every year, so that there are now more than 370. Probably by the end of this year, more than 400,000 cases diagnosed and identified, and estimates of 1.2 million people infected. This is the data just for St. Petersburg, and what you can see in this is an increase in the number of cases, also again peaking in 2001, primarily in injection drug users, a little bit of growth in the sexual and by heterosexual transmission and unknown routes of transmission, but now there are 35,000 cases diagnosed in St. Petersburg overall. We've watched the prevalence grow, looking at convenience samples taken in 1998, 2000, 2001 at syringe exchange programs. We saw the percentage of infected injection drug users mount sort of inexorably, 2%, 11%, 19%, and the syringe program, exchange program in St. Petersburg was hampered tremendously by lack of funding. Olga, sitting in the audience, was part of this program at the time. Municipal support and active police opposition. This is a picture of the syringe exchange bus that was the couple of days before the syringe exchange people were going to release a report about how the police were extorting money and drugs from drug users. Their bus was firebombed. And then, if I'm not mistaken, it was dragged off to a parking lot and was firebombed again, just so the people who ran the exchange, you know, didn't think it might have been an accident. But one of the things we needed was better sampling of injection drug users, and since that 2001 data, we've done this twice. We sampled drug users in a set of studies. The first one was funded by the HIV Prevention Trials Network, and the second, which is ongoing now, is funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. The first one was part of a large set of studies in four places around the world to recruit cohorts of drug users for seroincident studies. Recruitment in St. Petersburg was a mixed method recruitment using venue-based, street outreach, and chain referral. In the end, 900 injectors were screened, 520 were enrolled for the one-year follow-up, and when we looked at where they came from around the city, they were randomly scattered throughout the residential areas of the city. The more recent study, the ongoing SATCAP study, as it's called, was designed as a cross-sectional study using respondent-driven sampling. The initial weighting that we've done of the sample from the first wave suggested it's representative of IDUs from around the city. In this study, we recruited not only injection drug users, but we recruited their sex partners as well as men who have sex with men and their female sex partners, to look not just at transmission of HIV within the core risk groups of injection drug users and men who have sex with men, but also the people who might be potential bridges to the general population. Study in wave one, 387 injection drug users were enrolled. going back to the first study, the HPTN, what we saw was at baseline, 30% of the individuals were infected. No difference really at all between this green population as a whole and the people who ended up being enrolled in the cohort in terms of all the behaviors. The only significant difference here was the people who were enrolled were slightly older, and although it doesn't look significant, it actually was, and one of the things that makes it significant is that we could not find a single injection drug user over the age of 30 who was HIV positive. Something about social networks. We won't get into that here. What was interesting when we followed people for 520 people for a year afterward, there were 20 seroconversions, an incidence rate of about 4.5% per year. The only factor we could find that was significantly associated with getting an HIV infection during that year was the injection of amphetamines or other psychostimulants derived from ephedrine. But one of the studies tells us is the limitations of traditional epidemiology. There were no risk behaviors that we could associate with the prevalent HIV cases in that in this study. You know, the association of prevalent cases was only in people over, you know, under 30. Nothing about what it was about using methamphetamine could explain transmission. And there were absolutely no variables in common between the prevalent and the incident cases. So in order to try to get a better handle on what could possibly be causing this epidemic in St. Petersburg, we began to do some geographic mapping. And what we found most interestingly was that HIV was clustered in certain geographic regions of the city. There's one cluster here, and there's one cluster, there's actually three clusters in this part of town, one, two, three, all of which are restricted to about 5% or so of the residential area of the city. And what's interesting is that when we then mapped on top of that where we could observe similar clusters of risk behaviors like syringe sharing and high rates of heroin use, they co-clustered to the same areas as HIV prevalence co-clustered. And interestingly, what also co-clustered there, for the most part, was living with parents. So quite sort of counterintuitively, living with parents is not protective. When we looked at the incident cases, we could map 18 of the 20 of them. They weren't themselves clustered. There's just not enough of a large enough N for statistical significance. But what is interesting is that 10 of those clusters mapped in to or adjacent to the prevalence clusters. So there were six mapping around this area here in St. Petersburg on the Petrograd Island near City Market. And here in the east part near the Ladoshka Metro stop, another four of the incident cases mapped. So, basically, just to stop temporary conclusion on this part of this first study, the HPTN study, is using techniques like spatial mapping, we can now say that we know a great deal more about the incident, the incidence and the prevalence and the spread of this epidemic in St. Petersburg. Disappointment is that we really did this analytical work only now. If we had done this analytical work in 2003 in real time, we could have had a huge impact on prevention by saying, look, you don't have much resources, but you focus your efforts here and here, and you're going to make a big impact on the epidemic. So we're trying to do in this new study real-time mapping, and at the end I'll show you one of those maps. In this study, you know, one of the things we learned was we recruited not just injection drug users, but drug users, and confirmed what we already knew, that drug use in Russia is overwhelmingly by injection. These are young people. Despite what Dr. Moore says, they are sexually active. We'll get to that. Their median age for both the MSM and the IDU in our population was in their late 20s. And the HIV in this bridging population is high. You'll notice that among sex partners of IDUs who we recruited into this study, their HIV prevalence was already 16%. Prevalence in the drug users had reached 50%. So it had gone up from 30% in 2002 to 50% now. This is an epidemic that is still growing. And if you look at the maps, this is the city mapped by neighborhood. And what you can see comparing 2002 to 2006 is that in the size of the pies are proportional to the number of people in each of the separate samples. But you'll notice that in almost every neighborhood, the HIV prevalence, the size of the darker wedge of pie, is increased, not just in our two neighborhoods where we saw the epidemic first, but also especially in some of the areas now in the more northerly parts of the city and in the south, in the southwestern parts of the city. We're in the process right now of trying to map where our recent HIV infections are in the hope of being able to advise in real time where to put prevention resources, but for now this is the most recent data we have on this. In contrast to the New York work where 98% of the people were HIV, had been HIV tested in the past, here only 3/4 of the people had been tested in the past in some location in some way for some reason. What was interesting is that among the people, 17% of those people who'd been tested before had not been told what their status was. They didn't know what their status was. Of the 60% who told us they were negative at last test, 24% of them are now positive. Of the people who'd never been tested before, almost 60% of them were positive. 60% of the people who didn't know their status was, or I think I never said that, were positive. If you calculate the sensitivity of self-report for true HIV status, it's only 36%, which is incredibly low. So not only do we need prevention programs out there, but we need better testing programs out there. We took the data, because as I said, this is a cross-sectional study, not a longitudinal study, so we had to come up with ways to try to estimate incidence, and we developed two methods. My colleague Linda Nicolai came up with the idea of this retrospective cohort, which takes into account self-reported prior HIV testing and prior HIV status that they reported about that prior testing. And it involves all those people who reported themselves negative at the last test before they came into our study. The second methodology is an enzymatic assay methodology. It takes into account all those people who have a positive HIV test when they walk in our door. There's a second test you can use that can detect those who are likely to have a recent infection. It, with some accuracy, predicts the likelihood of people having been infected in approximately the last half year or so. The retrospective cohort, we had 173 people who we could analyze this way, 41% of whom got infected. The incidence rate that we estimated from this retrospective cohort is 17.3%. That's comparable to the rates that they saw in New York at the very beginning of the epidemic, when the HIV prevalence in drug users went from 0% to about 50% in about 3 or 4 years. This is already 10 years into this epidemic, and we're still seeing phenomenally high incidence rates. The estimate from this BED assay is even higher at 28% per year of the uninfected getting infected. Clearly, as my title of the abstract indicates, we are seeing ongoing and significant epidemic in St. Petersburg that demands our immediate attention. As of last year, half of the IDUs were already infected, and prevalence is going to continue to increase, since the incidence rates, if you believe our incidence estimates, but we have two that overlap, and they overlap in confidence intervals of between 18 and 22% per year. And it's clear that St. Petersburg needs much more active prevention programs that target drug users and their environment, and they need to be established in St. Petersburg. We need to learn more about and overcome the barriers to HIV testing. We need more active prevention for the core groups, injection drug users of MSM, and for their bridges to the general population. And we need, because this increase in injection drug use, in HIV and injection drug use, is also associated with recruitment of new, young, uninfected drug users, we need more research on factors associated with the initiation of injection drugs in St. Petersburg youth. I want to acknowledge the people who were responsible for the work on this study, my Russian colleagues from the HPTN, Drs. Kozlov, Chipoltis, Rivochkin, Tusova, who's sitting in the audience, Russell Barber, Skip, who did the mapping, Irving Hoffman, who's PI of the HPTN study, and our current ongoing NIDA funded study. Again, Andre and Olga, Sergey, Linda, Skip, Ted White at Yale, and the coordinating center led by Martin Bucci and Rand. This study is ongoing, and hopefully next year we'll be able to present more data. For those of you who are here and not in the adjacent room where another SAPCAP presentation is being presented absolutely simultaneously, you won't hear that, but maybe next year we can organize this better so you can get all of our studies discussed in one room, not overlapping. But thank you all for listening, for your forbearance, and for hanging in till the bitter end of this conference. any questions? Yes? There are some HIV support groups. Most immediately what happens is I go back to St. Petersburg next week, and Dr. Kozlov has arranged for a meeting that we will be having, which is a follow-up to a meeting he had last month when he presented our current, you know, incidence data that actually shocked the hell out of the local public health committee and a group that included, really for the first time around the table, the deputy director of the public health committee, the chief substance abuse officer for the city, the head of the City AIDS Center, the chief of the TB Center, the chief of the Social Services Administration of the city, all of whom will be coming together again next week at a meeting we're going to be presenting them at, where we're actually going to be using data from New York, where they successfully reversed an incredibly large heroin epidemic, an HIV epidemic among drug injectors, successfully, and we're going to be suggesting the same approach, and we're going to be suggesting that we help them evaluate and make sure that they're doing the right thing. So that's the immediate first steps. The second step is we're also engaged in a process of working with the AIDS Center to add case management capabilities to their treatment program. They do have access to drugs. They have been reluctant to treat drug users. They thought they might be wasting their drugs on these people. But we're adding case management to that in an attempt to show them that, in fact, yes, just like in your study in New York, where so many of the people are receiving care for HIV disease, that you can do it and you can keep them in care. So we're trying on several fronts to make a difference, and I hope that at some point we can come back and have some more favorable news. But until then, we'll keep trying. I mean, that's why we're in public health, right? Yeah. Other questions? Yes. Where did we get our seeds from? It was a question, where did we get our seeds from? Yeah. works properly, it's irrelevant who the seeds are, so long as the seeds refer other people. And you can begin the chain and the waves of recruitment. Yeah, okay, well, if afterwards, if you press her, she'll tell you stories about us going to the gay clubs together. Yes. That's about six dissertations. There's all sorts of social factors that contribute to an increase in drug use. The falling borders of the former Soviet Union, the increase in organized crime, the desire on the part of young people to be different from their parents, so less interest in alcohol, more interest in Western psychoactive substances. You know, how much chicer can heroin be in some places? You know, we push this image that you know, it's a very cool drug, and I think it's had an enormous negative impact. Another thing that's changed the dynamic of heroin use in Russia is the accessibility in many places of commercially available heroin. Heroin that people used to use in Russia, people made themselves from poppies or from opium gum. It was a sort of communal activity in people's kitchens, stuff they made. The Russian, it's called this chernaya, which is Russian for black, because the stuff was just this horrible, thick, viscous liquid that no one in their right mind would want to inject, but some people did. And with the availability of commercial heroin, which you can go to the street corner and get a little bit of and dissolve it easily, you know, it makes it much easier to get initiated into drugs. So there are all these factors that associate with increase in prevalence of drug use among young Russians. And you know, the interesting thing is that those older drug users who were used to the homemade drugs, their prevalence of HIV is very low. It's only with this transition to commercial heroin that you're seeing both a large increase in drug users and a large spread of HIV among that increasing population. And it's estimated in St. Petersburg, a city of 4.1 million, that there's about 70,000 injection drug users. So that's not unlike the situation in New York, where they talk about a city that's twice the size with twice as many injection drug users. Yes. Who are you again? Predictor of incidents. I mean, I have a hypothesis which is virtually untested, and that is that in the year 2003, it's right after the United States invaded Afghanistan, and the supply of heroin worldwide went down, and those people who were serious enough drug users to continue will transition from one drug to the other based on what's available. Look at drug users in the United States. An enormous number of them are polydrug users. They, you know, they do speedballs. They shoot mixtures of heroin and cocaine. They smoke crack and shoot up at this, you know, heroin. They do all sorts of things. They mix their drugs. If you talk to them, and you know, from my ethnographic, limited ethnographic work, I've learned that people will actually say very counter, you know, if they're really heavy drug users, they'll say very counterintuitive things about their drugs, about how heroin speeds them up and and methamphetamine slows them down, or cocaine slows them down, which makes no sense to the naive person, but sort of makes sense to the way these drugs change the pathways in the brain, and you end up with addictive disorders where people use heroin to basically feel normal after a while. And if they don't have the heroin to feel normal and they need something to stimulate that limbic system, that dopaminergic system that's at the root of addiction, that transition to methamphetamine is not surprising. And so, you know, we have anecdotal stuff. I remember going to the emergency, the poisonings ward in the emergency hospital in the summer of 2002, just after we'd invaded Afghanistan. And I talked to the residents who were earning $40 a month. At first, they were very reluctant to talk to us because they were worried that they might lose their $40 a month jobs for talking to foreigners. But they agreed finally to talk to us. And one of the things they said is, you know, we're only seeing, you know, 8 or 9 people a month here now. We used to be seeing, you know, 35 or 40 people a month with heroin overdoses. We're not seeing any heroin overdoses. It's clear that the amount of heroin that's being used in the 2003 study, in 2002-2003, is relatively low. Average amount numbers of injections is not what you would expect for your average, Western drug user 3 times a day, 7 days a week, but closer to once a day, because supplies were really limited. Does that answer the question? I think we're seeing. I mean, and the funny thing is that I would say of those people in that 2003 study, 20% reported some methamphetamine use, about 92% reported heroin. So there's about 18% of people who were engaging in using both drugs simultaneously. I think for the current study, again, it's overwhelmingly heroin and less methamphetamine use. And the funny thing is, it's not really methamphetamine. That's another a bit of ethnography we did. We went and we asked people how they were actually making their methamphetamine, and we discovered that they weren't reducing their ephedrone or their ephedrine to methamphetamine. They were oxidizing it to methcathinone, a mild psychostimulant, much more short-lived one than methamphetamine. So you would ask a question. We have almost no, well, we have very, very few MSM IDs. We had 5. We don't, and in our study, we asked the MSM about their drug use, and if they reported methamphetamine use, even not by injection, they would be put in a DU, drug user, MSM category, and there are very few of those. So the drug use in our study is limited to heroin or other opiates, methamphetamine or methcathinone, because we can't really tease them apart, and cocaine. And those drugs have not yet widely penetrated the MSM population in St. Petersburg to the best of our study. That's what our study tells us. We're running wave 2 this year with many more MSM. Maybe we'll have a better handle on it by the end of the year.
And I have one question. Well, after 4 o'clock, okay. If they would just say privately to us, that would be great. But thank you.
Thank you all for your attention.